We hope you enjoy this recording of a live broadcast brought to you via the ETIM Network, the online, live, interactive division of Torah in Motion. For more learning opportunities, please visit www.torahinmotion.org.
Okay, it's already 9 o'clock, so I'd like to start. I had things... I'll tell you another time. I had things that I wanted to talk about, but in the interest of time, I don't even think we'll finish Rhinus today. We'll get close to it. I want to get started. But before I do, just one thing call your attention to, just because Rabbi Hirsch mentioned it last class, the Rav of Hartford. He's the author of this book. It's a commentary on Sefer HaMitzvot, Yad HaLevi. You can see how sick it is. It's a very interesting book. It's considered one of the best commentaries on the Sefer HaMitzvot, and inside he also deals with some contemporary issues. For example, he has a long attack on Louis Ginsburg, who he regards as a complete heretic. Why does he attack though Ginsburg? Ginsburg, during Prohibition, when wine was banned, although there was an exemption for sacramental purposes, there was a problem because you had all these rabbis who were illegally producing it under the permission for sacramental purposes and selling it in all sorts of liquors. So there was big Chil Hashem. Rabbis were busted. There's a whole article on this. So Louis Ginsburg has a 75-page responsum permitting the use of grape juice. And Hurwitz attacks him. Now, this is terrible. It's obviously incorrect. And what's ironic is that today we all rely we're not relying on Ginsburg, but other poskim who say the exact same thing Ginsburg said. When you read Shuvot like that, it's hard not to conclude that had it not been a conservative figure who wrote the Shuva, that the response would have been very different. And we see this in numerous examples. In fact, recently Ari Zivotofsky wrote about the swordfish, the kashrus of swordfish, and his claim is that it's only because the conservatives really jumped on the swordfish bandwagon that the Orthodox rabbis ruled it was forbidden. Because if you look in the 30s and 40s, even to the 50s and 60s, you had many Orthodox rabbis permitting it. But what Rabbi Hirsch mentioned about this sefer is that in the middle, yeah, same as ethics, same as prenuptial agreements, the whole bit. On page 143 and 143A and 143B, that's where he has his famous defense of the women not covering their hair, which became very well known. But it's only two pages in a book of well over 500 pages that deals with all aspects of the Sefer HaMitzvot and is really a standard text. If you read Rabbi Shadel's edition, for example, of the Sefer HaMitzvot, he's often quoting this. Okay, let's just return to Rav Rhinus. There's a lot to do. I did want to mention, one thing I forgot to mention was Geula Bat Yehuda. In this book, she points out one thing I didn't say, that Rav Chaim's Chidushim, why they were accepted, another reason, is that they're short. And Rhinus, you have to go into pages and pages. This brings us back to what we spoke about with Rav Moshe Feinstein, maybe why the Gibberish Moshe were never really accepted. Okay, but now we're into Zionism, we're going to do Zionism and his yeshiva. Question is, what led Rhinus to become a Zionist? It's not an obvious or natural thing. I ended, before we got cut off, by saying that the 1881 pogroms showed that there were real problems for Jews in Russia. Rhinus writes about how the redemption is above any natural process of human endeavor. When you think about religious Zionist thinkers, we usually have this image, and they write about this, Cook and others, that the redemption is going to come naturally, in a natural process. However, Rhinus has a very different perspective on it. Rhinus does not share the notion of Geula Tivit, of a natural redemption. He sees the redemption as being full of miracles, very far removed from the contemporary world. The upshot of this is that everything we do in the land of Israel, building it up, is not part of the redemptive process, and has nothing to do with ultimate redemption. Settling the land is valuable, and we'll see why it's valuable. But it has nothing to do with redemption. It's valuable in raising the spiritual level of the Jews and other things, as we'll see right now. He has a vision, much like Kalischer, of agricultural colonies. In fact, he sees Nazis Jews moving from being merchants to working the land, which he sees as a much more authentic way of being Jewish. In fact, he says that the reason the Torah forbids taking money on interest is precisely because it doesn't really want people to be merchants. But that's the last resort. But really, it's much better, much more wholesome when we're working the land. And he says, as all farmers do, that there's no life as working on the land. There were many Orthodox who were opposed to Reines' approach of settling the land. One of the reasons was, this really is different from the opposition to Kalischer, was that now non-religious Jews started getting involved, both in Zionism and in settling the land. But Reines begins the process of looking at the glass half full, not half empty, and pointing out that these non-religious people settling in the land, their Judaism could be affected positively from settling in the land. The traditionalist position was that all these non-religious Jews settling in the land were making the land impure, and the land would have to spit them out. Reines argued that the land could purify them. He also argued that the traditionalist argument was ludicrous, because he said that just because the non-religious are doing the mitzvah of settling the land, that doesn't mean we should not do it. The non-religious do lots of mitzvot. Does that mean we're not going to give tzedakah? We're not going to do anything else? By the way, he also, in the Limud Zchut, he finds all this justification, tries to defend the non-religious. He does so with the Orthodox as well. He's the first one, to my knowledge, who responds to the Reform criticism of the Orthodox synagogue service. The Reform argued that the Orthodox synagogue service was a disgrace, basically, that the people were not respectful, children were running around. And Reines points out, and I heard my father say this years ago even, that the difference is when the Reform go to synagogue, it's like a museum. It's not a place they feel comfortable. They go there a couple times a year. When the Orthodox are there all the time, and therefore, it's only to be expected that they're much more comfortable, and it's not like you're visiting someone who has, the special plastic on the couch, and you can't go in certain rooms. That's not the way the Orthodox relate to the synagogues. It's not an institution like a church, like he said the Reform temples are, where everyone has to be still and quiet. Now, he does point out that the Torah is concerned with lack of reverence, as we see on Yom Kippur, and with the high priest going into the Holy of Holies, and Aaron was not supposed to come too often into the Mishkan. However, the synagogue is not the Mishkan, and it's not the Holy of Holies. We're there every week. So we need to find, he says, a middle ground between reverence of the sort that we express, let's say, in the Holy of Holies, and complete chaos and anarchy. And that's his defense of the traditional synagogue service. I will tell you, though, incidentally, that the German Orthodox actually shared the Reform critique of the East European Orthodox Shtiebel approach. They, too, thought it was lacking in dignity, and there wasn't, from the German Orthodox perspective, first of all, this idea where everyone is davening together at the same time at different points of the service, or that maybe there's a niggun and everyone's singing. No. In the German Orthodox, you sat quietly, you listened to the chazan, or maybe a choir as well. It was a very different type of service. Synagogue service we have today is very much an American service. The communal singing that we have in all our synagogues is really very much a North American Protestant innovation. I'm convinced of this, that we took this over. The young Israels at the turn of the century really adopted this. They saw what the Protestant churches were doing, and therefore you have communal singing. Because in the traditional synagogue, even when the German synagogues, you listened to the choir or the chazan. You didn't sing along. And if you've been to yeshivas, they don't sing when they open the ark, and they don't sing all the things. And even the ones they do sing, like the chadodi, you can't sing along because the chazan sings, and you're just supposed to say it quietly. Chassidim did not sing. What you had sometimes is you had nigunim. They would hum it. But you did not have joint singing like we have. I have been unable to find any evidence before you come to America. And to this day, Hasidic shtiebels, they don't have. You have the chazan will sing something and the people will hum along. But as we sing, like when we open the ark and when we carry the Torah around the synagogue and all these things, this is very much a modern Orthodox American thing, which to this day you don't find in Haredi shuls. I don't think it's the effect of Karabakh. This predates Karabakh by a long shot. I mean, Karabakh came up with different tunes, certainly. But this this is something you find in America in the early part of the 20th century. Are there tshuvot against the singing? I don't know of any. I'm offhand. I'm sure there are tshuvot against the singing because it is chadash. I don't know, and I don't know today what they do in the German Orthodox, in the Washington Heights Minyan, if it's still more of a spectator sport. I know that I've been to Spanish and Portuguese. You sit back, and I wasn't sure what you're supposed to do. You listen to the choir and the chazan. I wasn't sure whether I'm supposed to sing along or anything, and I looked around. No one else was, so I didn't as well. It's very much, though, and England also. In England, modern Orthodoxy is very much... The Rav was against singing? Okay, well, the Rav could be against singing, but if you take away people singing, then they're not going to have a davening. That's all I could say. Doesn't feel anyone who davens in the Yeshiva Sheminyan, when they go up and they take the Torah out of the Ark and they don't even sing Day, and then when they return the Ark, they don't sing it, you really feel like this is not davening. If you were brought up with this, I'm sure when they come to our shuls, they feel like this is some show or something. Getting back to Rav Reines, he sees Zionism as the first step on a passage of tshuva. Now, as for cooperating with the non-religious, he makes an easy distinction. He says that we don't cooperate with them for ideals. That is, we don't compromise our ideals because of the non-Orthodox, but for practical purposes, to build up the land or anything, to fight anti-Semitism, there we do cooperate with them. And we spoke about this earlier, about Hirsch's position versus Hildesheimer, how Hildesheimer also believed in cooperating for practical purposes, whereas Hirsch thought no cooperation whatsoever. So Reines is along the Hildesheimer model. You didn't have separate kahilas in Eastern Europe, so the issue of having a separate Orthodox kahila wasn't even something to consider. In fact, his limud zchus, his justification of the non-religious, goes so far as to explain why they are so dominant in the Zionist movement. They became very important and popular in the Zionist movement because, he says, they were so interested in assimilation and fitting in, the pogroms hit them much harder than the traditional Jews. The traditional Jews always assumed that they would live a second-class citizenship, that they would live in the ghetto. But the non-Orthodox saw so much hope in the, you know, after Tsar Nicholas was done with, and you have the new Tsar Alexander, and the freeing of the serfs, and there was all sorts of thoughts that the Jews would be brought into Russian society. When the pogroms came, that hit them much harder. So naturally, they moved into a Zionism. In fact, it was so important for him to keep the non-religious together with the religious in the fight for the land of Israel, that at one of the early Mizrahi conventions, and we'll speak in a minute about what Mizrahi is, one of the speakers, the Orthodox speaker, got up and started rebuking the non-Orthodox. The non-Orthodox men were sitting there with heads uncovered, and they were sitting together, men and women, whereas the Orthodox women were sitting on one side and the men on the other. And this rabbi was saying that what you're doing is wrong, etc. Reines gets up and says, when people are guests in your house, and these non-religious are guests at our Mizrahi convention, we don't rebuke them, and we don't tell them how they should live their life. Reines actually joins the Zionist movement at the same time that other Gedolim were leaving the movement. What happened is that the Zionist movement at the end of the 19th century decides to include culture in its formula. Okay, does anyone else not have sound? Or is this only, can someone email me about sound? Sound is good, okay. That's my father, so I'll say, Dad, it's only on your computer. Let me just give you two examples. You have Rav Eliyahu Klatskin and Rav Eliyahu Akiva Rabinowitz, and as well as Rav Itzala Rabinowitz of Ponevezh, the famous Rav Itzala, who together with Rav Chaim Soloveitchik was the most important Rosh Yeshiva in Eastern Europe. These three people leave the Zionist movement when the Zionist movement decides that it's not just about developing the land of Israel, fighting for a state. It's also about bringing culture in, Jewish culture. That's obviously going to be dangerous for the Orthodox. because Jewish culture for the non-religious is going to mean something very different than for the Orthodox. Herzl did not approve of culture. He didn't want to bring the culture in if it would split the movement, but the others wanted to. Reinus was not opposed to teaching culture. Problem is, when you're involved with the non-Orthodox, and when they decided they have to teach what they called national education, it will create great problems. But Reinus thought this was not enough to leave, to split with Zionism. In fact, he joined Zionism right at that time. But what did he do? He said that although we cannot be with the general Zionists because they insist on a certain type of culture, we will form our own Zionist organization. And he called it Mizrahi. And thus the Mizrahi movement was born. In fact, we know that Herzl was really the motivating factor behind forming Mizrahi, because Herzl did not want to lose the Orthodox. He was much more sensitive to the Orthodox than many of the others. And this would enable there to be an Orthodox bloc of Zionists who would support his political program, because his political program, as we'll see, was opposed by many of the Russian Chovevei Tzion. It was now, when Reinus is in support, is the leader of a religious Zionist party, at the same time that the general Zionist movement is focusing on culture, and many Gedolim have now left the Zionist movement, that the Orthodox really turn on Reinus. The Chafetz Chaim even travels to Lida to convince him to leave the Zionist movement. Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg, in his beautiful essay on Reinus, speaks about how they explain to Reinus that if he just leaves the Zionist movement, he'll be, you know, he could take his place among the Gedolim. But if he remains in the movement, he'll be an outcast. And that's exactly what would happen. What happened? Nothing could change his mind. And the rabbis stopped inviting him to rabbinic conferences. He stopped being included among the Gedolei Yisrael. We've spoken in the classes previous, especially in the classes dealing with Rav Unterman, how to be a Mizrahi supporter at this time required enormous courage, because the leadership, the majority, the overwhelming majority of the Gedolim, the great rabbis, were opposed to Mizrahi. They weren't all anti-Zionist. Many of them supported the ideal, but they didn't think that you could be involved with the Zionist movement, because until the Zionist movement was no longer led by the non-Orthodox, although they supported Chovevei Tzion, at the present they said there was no place for an Orthodox Jew in the Zionist movement. So you had a lot of younger rabbis. It's sort of like, I think, like the modern Orthodox, the RCA. You always had a lot of the younger rabbis, the influential rabbis, but you only had a couple Gedolim. That's what Mizrahi was like. The old-timers didn't want to have anything to do with it. Now, there's no reason at present, in the interest of time, that is, no need for us to go into the details of the history of Mizrahi, maybe in a future class. Let me just say that it took up most of Reinus's energies and most of his writing related to Mizrahi from the end of the 19th century until his death in 1915, but we would be remiss if we didn't mention the 6th Zionist Congress in 1903, at which Uganda, which really is not Uganda, it's Kenya, but it was called Uganda then, was discussed. The British government had proposed to the Zionists to establish an autonomous colony in East Africa. This came after the breakdown of an earlier plan called the El Arish Plan, in which Jews would be settled in North Sinai. The problem was there was no water, so that wasn't going to go anywhere, and the Egyptians refused to allocate water from the Nile for irrigation. Now, the British wanted East Africa developed, so they had a reason for bringing the Jews in there. Herzl supported this, and he had his own motivations. First, he would create good ties to the British, which would stand them in good stead in later years with regard to the land of Israel. Second, the people who would settle in East Africa would be the future nucleus for settlements in the land of Israel. Even though it was ruled by the Turks, Herzl and others were sure that in the future either the rulership would change, Britain had enormous influence in that part of the world, or the Turks would begin allowing real settlement there. Herzl always saw East Africa as a temporary step, not permanent settlement, and yet it led to great disputes in the Zionist movement. Yes, well, we're getting to what Reinus says. What you say is 100% correct. The Zionist movement could have split, maybe would have split over this However, the British withdrew its offer in 1904 after 1 year, so the issue never came to a head. But the biographers of Herzl all stress that his premature death was due in large measure to this, to the stress over the conflicts. Even after the British withdrew the offer, though, in 1905 at the 7th Zionist Congress, the delegates voted against any Uganda, now or in the future. It was a public rebuke to Herzl. Who were the people that supported Herzl and who voted for Uganda? It was the Mizrahi. And this was shocking to so many of the Zionists, the non-religious Zionists. After all, the Orthodox are the ones who pray every day for a return to the land of Israel, to Jerusalem. The non-Orthodox don't pray. The Orthodox do, and yet the Orthodox, from the non-Orthodox perspective, are willing to sell out the land of Israel for Uganda. But Reines stressed that while his heart was in Israel, and Israel is the only home for the Jews, Uganda is what he called a miklat, a place of refuge. This was after the pogroms in the 1880s. It was after the Kishinev pogroms. There were so many other problems in Eastern Europe. Poverty was, it was incredible, the poverty that Jews were suffering there. There was persecution. The chance to develop a Jewish lifestyle away from persecution, away from assimilation, if it was a choice between the United States, Western Europe, and creating a Jewish land, even if it's in East Africa, Reines says, we go to East Africa. It would be a place where Jews could develop their national feelings, their religious feelings, where they could organize for their future goal of reaching the land of Israel. Jews could be free, Reines said. And when Jews are free, they become strong in spirit, strong in body, and they will have much more influence to push their rights to the land of Israel. Living in the ghetto, in Tsarist Russia, they have no influence with what goes on in the world. Living on their own, in their own land, they would have influence. He wrote, quote, we have agreed to the African proposal because we are attentive to the needs of the people, and more than we love the land, we love the people. That is, the needs of the people are more important. He says, the people's situation is deteriorating morally and spiritually, therefore we must take any refuge we can. If there is no people of Israel in the world, there is no Zion in the world. He also says, quote, the Mizrahi as a religious party places the existence of the Jewish people above the mitzvah and the desire to return to the land of Israel. This is even though he says that the return to the land of Israel is the foundation of Jewish life, yet the existence of the Jewish people is more important than the return to the land of Israel. So this is a big difference between Reines and Kalischer. In addition, we have to say that Kalischer came to his view completely from traditional sources, as we saw. Reines, however, his nationalism was very much influenced by the modern concept. And I will say, and hopefully we'll get back to this today, Rav Soloveitchik's model, and not just a Soloveitchik's model, the Mizrahi until 1967 was a Rav Reines Mizrahi. It followed his approach that the land of Israel is about miklat, it's about refuge, it's about a place where Jews can develop themselves spiritually, they can be free of persecution. It's not about creating some sort of messianic state. It's not what Zionism became after 1967. Now, although most of his efforts were devoted to Mizrahi, and I hope to come back a little later again, but we need to get back to his idea of a modern yeshiva in the time we have left today. We spoke last class about how the idea failed earlier in Shvenetzian, but it was now time to try again. And in 1905, he opened a yeshiva in Lida, the name of the yeshiva, Torah Vadas, although it's usually referred to as the Lida yeshiva. Torah, we know what Torah is, Das, meaning secular studies. The plan was to have two sections, one for young people and one for rabbis. The young people would have a real curriculum of secular studies along with Torah studies, and the future rabbis would also have a curriculum that would be enlarged with diktuk and darshanut, the preaching, and also secular studies, so that days every Russian city had to have a rabbi who was recognized by the government to have secular education. So in the big cities, you had two types of rabbis. You had the crown rabbi, and then you had what they called the spiritual rabbi, the rabbi who decided Shiloh's on halacha. However, small towns couldn't afford to have two rabbis. So it was obviously advantageous to have a rabbi who was also a crown rabbi. And you had many traditionalists. Rabbi Weinberg, Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg, had enough secular education that he was able to pass the test to be a crown rabbi. And you had a number of others. But the old-fashioned rabbis, for the most part, couldn't do this. They didn't know any Russian, even though they lived in Russia. Rhinus was trying to train a new generation of rabbis. Now, I'll tell you, just by a side point, when Yeshiva Torah Vadas in America was opened, one of the founders of it was Zev Gold. Zev Gold, about whom Machon Gold is named, it doesn't exist anymore in Israel. In my day, he was one of the leading girls yeshiva with Michala. He was a rabbi in Scranton, Pennsylvania, Zev Gold. He's one of the early leaders in Mizrahi. He then moves to Williamsburg. After he moves to the land of Israel, he's one of the signers of Israel's Declaration of Independence. You have a number of Orthodox signers. But he was rabbi in Williamsburg, and he decided it was time to open a yeshiva. Torah Vadas Yeshiva, in which he was one of the founders, was opened by Mizrahi. And they called it Torah Vadas precisely because it was named after the same sort of name of the leading yeshiva, and it was supposed to be the same sort of yeshiva, one which would have secular studies and the like. In fact, both Torah Vadas and Chaim Berlin were founded by Mizrahi, by what today we would call modern Orthodox Jews. But as you all know, they turned into Haredi yeshivas today. They're classic standard Haredi yeshivas. But even in the 50s and 60s, when they had turned into somewhat Haredi yeshivas, all the guys there still went to college at night, and some even went during the day. Today, I don't know if it's still standard for Chaim Berlin and Torah Vadas to send their. And if you look, though, who the graduates of Chaim Berlin was, I mentioned Professor Ellman before. Bernard Septimus, my teacher from Harvard. You have many, many important people. Norman Lamb comes out of Torah Vadas. These were not Haredi yeshivas, even when they became, to use the term today, more black. But these were both founded as Mizrahi institutions. And Shraga Feivel Mendelowitz, who took over Torah Vadas, he was a big follower of Rav Kook. Yes, Yerida Sadoro. So even more so, I would say, Dov, the typical Torah Vadas Bacher has no idea. Not only does he not know who founded the yeshiva and where the name comes from, if you ask him what does Torah Vadas mean, he won't even know. Well, Torah Vadas is Torah Maga. Yes, Rabbi Hirsch is correct. Before World War II, all the rabbis in America, for the most part, before the 1930s, all the rabbis were Mizrahi. In the 1930s, Agudas Yisrael finally gets a chapter going. But even through until after World War II, almost all the rabbis were Mizrahi rabbis. Agudas Rabbanim was a Mizrahi-dominated institution. All the Rosh Yeshiva, with almost no exceptions, the only exception is Rav Gorelick. All the Rosh Yeshiva at YU were Mizrahi. You had Rosh Yeshiva, the other great yeshivas, Mizrahi. Really, Rav Ruderman was Mizrahi. I believe you can call him Mizrahi. The reason he went to America, I heard this from his grandson, is he was in Rav Shapiro of Kovno, the Dvar Avraham, who himself was basically Mizrahi, his office, and he wasn't sure where he should go, the land of Israel or to America. And Meir Bar-Ilan, the son of the Netziv, the leader of Mizrahi, comes in to visit the Dvar Avraham, and the Dvar Avraham asks Bar-Ilan, what should he do? And it's Meir Bar-Ilan who told Rav Ruderman, go to America, they need rabbis there. Not only was everyone Mizrahi, even the rabbis who weren't Mizrahi had to fit in. Rav Kamenetsky, when he was in Toronto, was Rav of a Mizrahi shul. And I asked his son about this, and Rav Nelson said, because all the shuls were Mizrahi. So even if you're not a Mizrahi, you become a Mizrahiite. That's the way it was. I assume Chaim Berlin and Torah Vadas are still more of the more liberal of the Haredi yeshivas. Do they go to Harvard? I don't know. Professor Septimus didn't go to Harvard. I mean, he went to Harvard graduate school. He didn't go to undergraduate. He learned, and he went to college at the same time. And Rav Huttner knew exactly what he was doing. Rav Lichtenstein, of course, comes out of Chaim Berlin as well. I don't know if that's true. It could be, but Rav Huttner really wasn't in college very long. What was he? He was in the University of Berlin a few months. It would be interesting. I don't know if anyone's done the history of Chaim Berlin. There was big disputes in Chaim Berlin when he was hired. There was someone emailed me after I did my post on rabbis and communism. if I'm not mistaken, it's Rav Dovid Leibovitz, who then becomes the Rosh Hashiva of Chafetz Chaim. He was, if I'm not mistaken, it's not Harvard House, I think it's Chaim Berlin. He was a Rosh Hashiva there, and there was all sorts of machokas there, and people actually accused him of being a communist. But there's a whole history there to the various yeshivas. And the history, incidentally, continues with Chaim Berlin. I will tell you that the current Rosh Hashiva of Chaim, oh, it's Tarvadov, thank you. The current Rosh Hashiva of Chaim Berlin is actually under a cherem. I don't know if it was ever officially issued, but he was given hazmana by Rav Moshe Feinstein and numerous other gedolim to come to a din Torah, and he refused, and the penalty of not coming to a din Torah is that you're regarded as an outcast. And when he was included in the Moetzes Gedolei Torah there of Aguda, there were many people who were very angry. I could send anyone who's interested a copy of the letter of Shlomo Karabach, not Shlomo Karabach the singer. He was the mashgiach at the yeshiva, and Rav Schechter fired him, and he took them to Beis Din, and hazmana was issued by Rav Moshe Feinstein and others, and Rav Aaron Schechter just ignored it. And he was regarded by many, and you can still speak to Moshe Feinstein's sons. He was regarded as a menudah, as one who's really under the cherem. Because to violate a hazmana of the Gedolei Yisrael, to not to appear before Beis Din, and we all know what position that puts you in. And someone told me that he actually asked Rav Gustman, and Rav Gustman said he didn't have to go. All I know is that the Lithuanian Rosh Yeshiva saw him as an outcast, because how do you refuse a hazmat of Moshe Feinstein? So this was a huge conflict. And today, Chaim Berlin is not really one of the great yeshivas. It's really declined. But there's an interesting history, and it should be written as in Torah Vadas. The history of Yaakov Kamenetsky and Rav Shor, Gedalia Shor, they had huge machlokas, and you could speak to people. I even asked Rav Nussan about it, and he doesn't know what happened. He says one day his father came home, and he washed his hands with Gedalia Shor. Nothing to do with him ever again. And why, what the machlokas was about, I don't know. It's for someone to write about. Many of you probably have parents who were in Torah Vadas in the 50s and 60s. They can tell you about this, but it's nothing new. If you think that the machlokas only happens today, like in Ponevezh, where they throw kugel at each other and they hire hitmen to attack the Rosh Yeshiva, or you think that it only happened in Volozh and Tells, it's always happened. One of the only yeshivas that hasn't happened in is, believe it or not, Yeshiva University. You never had the terrible machlokas that you have in the other yeshivas, although in a future Sfarim post, I will write about a Rosh Yeshiva at Yeshivas Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan, who not only did he attacked the Rav in the most crude and vile way, and it's been completely covered up in the official histories of Yeshiva University. He writes about this in his Sfarim, he attacks the Rav. So, and I don't feel I'm revealing anything that's unknown. It's in the Rav, it's in this Rav's Sfarim, not just in one Sefer. Not just in one place, I'm saying. So you'll have to, be patient to get that bit of unknown Yeshiva University history. Okay, getting back to Rav Reines and Yeshiva Torah Vadas, he had one other point purpose that would be served by this yeshiva, that the Bachrim would be able to be open Zionists. In the other yeshivas, Volozh and Slobodka and the rest, they weren't officially anti-Zionists, many of them, because they stayed out of politics. The Rosh Yeshiva were anti-Zionists, many of them, in these yeshivas. They were Agudists, but they did not join the Aguda because they got a lot of their money from the Mizrahi type. So they were in the middle. And they banned all politics in the yeshiva. So you couldn't have an Agudist Yisrael sniff, and you couldn't have a religious Zionist, when a sniff is a branch, you couldn't have a religious Zionist branch there. In Volozh, incidentally, you had, even during the Chav Beit Zion era, the Netziv, who was a big supporter of Chav Beit Zion, he said you cannot have an official Shlav Beit Zion branch, and Rav Issa Zalman Meltzer and Rav Moshe Mordechai Epstein, they were part of a secret organization, Nes Tziona, which was involved in Chav Beit Zion activities. But in Reines' yeshiva, you could be an open Zionist, obviously. That was the point of it, one of the points. He was challenged, though. Why open a yeshiva in Lida? Go to the land of Israel. That's where it should be. What type of Zionist is it, they said to Rav Reines? He's the head of Mizrahi, who opens a yeshiva in Chutz Laaretz. But Reines didn't see a contradiction. He said, most Jews today are in Chutz Laaretz, are in Russia. Therefore, the yeshiva needs to be here, and we need to train Russian rabbis. One day, when there's enough Jews in the land of Israel, we'll open a yeshiva there, too. And within a few years, the yeshiva had over 300 students and even a kollel. And they even had different grades. This is a very modern idea that the students can pass up from shir to shir. It was important to note, however, that Talmud study at this yeshiva was conducted on traditional lines. Rhinus was not a Rosh Yeshiva there. I mean, he was the Rosh Hashiva, but he didn't function as one. He raised money. He gave like a Musar Shir once a week. Sometimes he spoke on Talmud, but he did not give any of his new ideas. He didn't give his new derech in learning. He knew that this would not then take off. He loved the yeshiva enough that he didn't want to create problems by instituting a new method of learning. He kept it traditionally. Yes, Tells also had levels. But the Lida, I believe Lida was doing it before Tells, or the same. Tells had a gymnasium in the city where you studied secular studies. There was a girls' school there, and then you moved there. They had a very close relationship to the yeshiva. You moved from the gymnasium into the yeshiva. Tells was very different than today's Tells. Rav Shmuel Lazer Volk, who becomes an important figure at yeshivas Rav Yitzchak Elchanan, and by the way, he's the Rosh Yeshiva who had such problems with the Rav. A lot of it was jealousy. He himself, had he remained in Lithuania, would have been one of the great Rosh Yeshiva there. He always said that the Tells today is not the real Tells. It's a false Tells. You know, he knew the real Tells in Lithuania, and the Tells in Cleveland he thought was a phony Tells. As with every yeshiva, it's vital to get good Rosh Yeshiva. So who was Rhinus able to get? Well, he was able to get, by the way, Simcha Asaf. Later on becomes a Rosh Yeshiva there. The Supreme Court Justice in the state of Israel, very important figure, great Talmud Chacham. But before him, you had Rav Shlomo Palachek, the Meitzer Eloi. Perhaps Rav Chaim Soloveitchik's greatest student. You can read Nesson Kamenetsky's article in the Yeshiva College volume that Menachem Butler edited. He comes to Reitz in 1922, and in the previous class I spoke a bit about him, how he's the first great Rosh Yeshiva to come to America to teach Torah, not to raise money. He dies young, unfortunately. He has this gum disease. He dies in his 50s, which today could be cured by antibiotics. I told the famous story that Jeffrey Gurak tells at the beginning of his book on Jews and sports. However, the Meitzer says, why didn't they let us play sports when we were young? We would have learned just as much Torah, but we would have had a childhood. By the way, Gurak is coming out with a new book. I saw it. They were advertising it at the conference, called Orthodoxy in America. I saw the galleys. It should be out any week now. But so the Meitzer Eloi, Rav Shlomo Palachek, greater than Rav Baruch Ber. You know, Rav Baruch Ber lived much longer and had many more Talmidim. But they say that he was a closer Talmud greater. I don't know. You can have more than one Talmud Mufak. You have to say, I have to look at Kamenetsky again. If Kamenetsky agrees, he was the closest. He came, I think, when he was 10 or 11 years old. I don't remember all the details to Reb Chaim. Reb Baruch Ber also was an incredibly close Talmud. Maybe they were equally close. I will say that Reb Baruch Ber remained closer. Reb Baruch Ber, to the end of Reb Chaim's life, had a much closer relationship because Reb Chaim was very upset that the Meitzer left, that the Meitzer, that is, went to lead the yeshiva. Reb Chaim thought that Rhinus was a... He's quoted by Rav Aaron Soloveitchik as saying that Rav Rhinus was an apikoros. What does that mean, apikoros? Not in a halachic sense. I'm certain not that. But an apikoros in that he went against the view of the Gedolei Yisrael. And here, the Meitzer, Rav Shlomo Palachek, even though he knows that his Rebbe, his father figure, Rav Chaim, is an anti-Zionist. So when I say Rav Chaim is an anti-Zionist, I don't just mean an anti-Zionist. I mean the leading anti-Zionist. When you look at the books, the book published against Zionism in Europe, I think it's called Orlei Yesharim, who do you have in there? You have a few Rabbanim. You have the Lubavitcher Rebbe, you have Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, and a few others. Many of the other Gedolim did not want to contribute. They were skeptical of Zionism and all this, but they knew that there were many Gedolim, or many big Rabbanim, who supported it, and they didn't want to get involved. They were Poseach al Shnei Seitim, that they were on the fence. Rav Chaim and the Lubavitcher Rebbe were the leaders of the anti-Zionists, and this continues, incidentally, in the Brisker tradition in the land of Israel. They're like Eda Haredi, Satmar, anti-Zionist, and the Lubavitch also remained anti-Zionist, although with a Zionist flavor. I don't know what you say about Lubavitch today. So the Meitzer's Rebbe is the bleeding anti-Zionist, and he joins the Zionist yeshiva. But if you know about Litvish Rabbanim, the Lithuanian world, it makes perfect sense. In the Lithuanian world, Rabbanim did what they wanted. No, so your Rebbe was a big anti-Zionist? Okay. But in Litvox were always very cynical. They were always very open-minded, even free-thinking. So from in the Rabbinisha world, when I say free-thinking, just because your Rebbe says one thing, you say something else. And, of course, Lithuania, Vilna, is full of real free-thinkers, real maskilim. They're too smart in Lithuania. I mean, the heads, they have such brilliant minds. They can't follow just because their Rav says something. And just look at what the yeshivas were like. All these brilliant young men coming there, all of them turning out different. One different. Look at Sobotka, who graduates. Look at all the other yeshivas. They're all different, one from the other. That's the Lithuanian model. Yes, and remember, Moshe Soloveitchik himself ends up going to the Tachkamoni in Warsaw, which is a Zionist institution. And Rav Soloveitchik, the Rav, has his famous drasha, in which he speaks about why he abandoned his family tradition. But it's not just him. You have many Litvisha Gedolim who broke with their tradition and went a different way. That's what it means to be a Litvak. Now, the Lidi Yeshiva, he didn't have Das Torah in the sense that it comes later. That is, they did what they wanted to do. Now, of course, in the Lithuanian world, they have just as much Das Torah as in the Hasidisha world, but that did not exist at the early part of the 20th century. The Lidi Yeshiva exists until 1915. During World War I, there are real problems there. The Yeshiva has to leave Lida, then Reines dies. They try to reopen the Yeshiva, but it's unsuccessful. Yet it had a great influence on many people who studied there. It showed that it was possible to have a Yeshiva which combined secular studies and the most advanced Torah studies. It was the first yeshiva to do so. The first yeshiva to combine secular studies and Torah studies. So although Torah Vadas comes around and there was this ideal, it was named after the Lidi Yeshiva, there'd be a hope that, not that they'd offer, I don't know if there was ever an idea that they would actually offer secular studies as a Torah Vadas yeshiva, but that they supported this notion of combining secular studies. Nothing ever came of it. Yeshivas Rav Yitzchak Chanan came to fruition there, and they in many ways modeled themselves after the Lida Yeshiva. Any great people come out of it. No Gedolim, if that's what you mean. I think Rav Savitsky actually might have studied there a bit, Rav Mordechai Savitsky. He lived in Lida. I think he did study there. But you had important religious Zionist leaders. You had important Balabatim communal leaders. No Gedolim, no Rosh Yeshiva great Rosh Yeshiva that I know came out of it. Remember, the Yeshiva wasn't around very long. What are we talking? We're talking 10 years. But I don't know of any real Gedolim that came out of it. Give it another 30, 40 years, you would have had it. So this is a good person. I don't know if he actually officially studied there. He lived in Lida. He might have been... he couldn't have studied there. It closes in 1915, even when it opens up later. It wasn't the same Lidi Yeshiva. It does open, and it stays open for a little while longer. He might have studied in the reopened Lidi Yeshiva. I don't know. As far as I know, they didn't have this because the Rosh Yeshiva who came there were supportive of it. You know, YU, it's really a misnomer when we speak about Yeshiva University as having, Yeshiva Rav Yitzchak of having secular studies. It doesn't. There's a yeshiva, and then there's a secular branch. So there's no real combination. It's not like in Lida where it was one institution. So they did not, you didn't have people there who opposed the ideal. In that sense, it was like the Rabbinical Seminary of Berlin. Lidi Yeshiva was also the first yeshiva to focus on providing Torah learning to Balabatim. Remember what I said, the yeshiva was open for young people who were going to be Balabatim. And that it was understood that that's what they're going to be, and they were trained for this. The other yeshivot expected everyone who studied there to either just, you know, spend years and years studying to become a Rav, a Rosh Yeshiva. They didn't have this concept that you train Balabatim. Reines was educating the German, was educating the masses just like the German Orthodox did. That was his focus. In fact, he also pointed out that his graduates have a great advantage over the graduates in the other yeshivas. This was the time when you had a lot of young women getting secular educations. They were being taught by tutors. They were going to the Polish schools, the Russian schools. They were becoming secular educated, and you had a culture gap. These women, young women, Weinberg speaks about them, who knew Russian and Hebrew. They didn't want to marry a yeshiva bacher, who they thought was uncultured, who didn't know anything other than learning Gemara. They wanted someone who was cultured, who knew about the world, who had a secular education, who could have a job, more modern type of job. Reines points out that they would be forced to marry then people who didn't know Torah or maybe weren't even religious. He's going to be providing young men, Torah scholars, pious people, for these women to marry, to build bais nem on the Yisroel. There will no longer be a culture gap with the girls having no one to marry, being forced then to compromise, marrying non-religious guys or less religious guys. He saw it as important. Just like you have cultured Orthodox women, you're going to have cultured Orthodox men, and that's vital. And I think this is something, obviously, in the modern Orthodox world, and even the YU, the Ner Yisroel world, they realize that you need to have marriage partners. So you need to have some sort of compatibility, because these women, you know, the Stern graduates are not going to be marrying Lakewood guys. It just doesn't. So today, of course, you have plenty of Lakewood girls to marry Lakewood guys. You didn't have that. You didn't have this type of from women at the turn of the 19th century like you do today. They didn't have Beis Yaakov then or anything like that. So Reines says we are the only institution producing not just religious Balabatim. You had that in Germany also, but Balabatim who know how to learn. The classic example of what we have today, what they call Torah Uparnasa. People who know how to learn, but also are going to make a good living, etc. He explained that one of the big problems in Eastern Europe, and in this he looks to Germany, was that in Eastern Europe, the Orthodox are only concerned about spiritual things. They're not concerned about raising up a generation of people who are going to live in the world. Now, Reines didn't have in mind the same things German Orthodox had. He was not telling people to cut their payas and to shave their beards or anything like that. That does come, by the way, in Lithuania. In interwar Lithuania, everyone was clean-shaven, and the Bachrim were clean-shaven. Also, he's talking more about a secular education, a decent job, etc. It's 10 o'clock, but we're going to go 15 more minutes because we were cut off a little. I just want to give you a few examples more of his derech and learning, his approach. He said, for example, really a major theme of his learning is that when you find a Tana or an Amora who says a position in one tractate, you can relate this to everything else they said. And this becomes quite controversial because, today you could say that even the attributions are not certain, so the whole thing falls apart. Because you have an attribution by a certain Tana, and then you have another Tana somewhere else. Who says these attributions are correct? People often forget that the Talmud is quoting passages, braisos, said by Tanaim 200, 300, 400 years prior to this. I mean, because, based on oral traditions. Who says that these are accurate transmissions? Not to mention the fact we often have different gersot. But that was his idea. Let me give you an example, though, of his philosophical bent by how he deals with the following problem. The Talmud in Chagiga asks, what do you do about someone who says, how can I learn Torah? There's so many different opinions. How can I get a handle on it? It often seems that there's no truth. After all, if every single thing basically in Judaism, there's a dispute, there's an argument, people can get very frustrated and say, what's the point of learning? And if you ever have a question, if ever anyone asks you a shaila and you're not sure, I'm sure many rabbis are asked a question. They don't know off the top of their head the answer, so they say it's a machokas, I'll get back to you. Which means that they don't know the answer, but they'll find it out, and everyone can accept if you say it's a machokas. And there are actually sources in the Talmud that you can lie to your congregants. So that you tell them, don't tell them you don't know the answer. Make them think you know more than you know, so they'll continue to respect you. Now, in Ecclesiastes 12:11, they quote, it says, the words of the wise are as goes, etc., etc., they are given from one shepherd. And the Talmud specifically quotes this last clause. I'm just looking at the time here. I could go on this in 10 minutes, so let me just say that he uses this verse to develop an approach of how Torah study, even with all the machlokas, it still is valuable and it still is true. The Rav Soloveitchik also was interested in this. He too spoke about what is machlokas. From the Rambam's perspective, machlokas is a negative thing. The reason we have disputes is because we lost the tradition, and it would be a lot better if we didn't have disputes. From the Brisker perspective, from the Lithuanian perspective, the disputes also have very positive elements to it. Let me just briefly say, I'll briefly say his answer. He has a book. It's called Shari Ora V'Simcha. And he has another book, Ora V'Simcha. He just raises the question. I'll do it in 2 minutes. How can two opposite things be true? We say that they're both Torah truth. How can they be both Torah truth? Rav Soloveitchik speaks about the importance of machlokas in his eulogy for the Brisker Rav, if I'm not mistaken. Also in Halachic Man, I believe. Rav Reines explains that the Torah deals in generalities. Generalities, but the oral law is constantly responding to new circumstances. And this also is what allows for the possibility of chidush, of creating new ideas. According to this conception, disputes are not something accidental, but is basic to the system. Because the halachic system is based on human intellects. Remember, the Torah, the written law, only gives us generalities. All the details have to be worked out by us. Which means that by definition, machlokas, disputes, are built into the system, and it's not like we say, oh, unfortunately, we've forgotten so much, and if we have machlokas, no, by definition, they're supposed to be machlokas, because human intellects, by definition, lead to different understandings. In fact, Reines goes so far as to say that the disputes we find in the Talmud, not only are they necessary, they are what leads our mind to perfection. It's through argument that our minds are sharpened. If you, for the Rambam's understanding, where everything would be clear and the purpose of Talmud study is simply halakha, that goes against what Reines and Rav Soloveitchik say, that the purpose of the Talmud is precisely the argumentation, the sharpening of the intellect. Just think for a minute, what would Talmud study be like if there was no contradictions? The entire enterprise of Talmud study revolves around contradictions and questions and disputes, etc. Based upon this, Reines explains what it means, what the Talmud is talking about when it justifies studying views that are rejected by saying they're all from one shepherd. What does he say? Quote, "The search for truth is just as valued by God as the truth itself." What Reines says is really Brisker methodology. It's the Lithuanian approach that it's not about the end game. It's not about truth. It's not about getting to there. It's about how we get there. That is, the purpose of learning is the path. We never actually get there. We never get to absolute truth. But we're not supposed to get there. And it's the disputes. It's the discussions. That's what's valuable. Not like the Rambam thought that it's the result. It's the practical halakha. No. It's the road there. The road is always more exciting than the path, the journey, is always what makes it worthwhile. Getting there is sometimes not so important. Okay. Dynamics for dispute. Yes, thank you. A few more minutes. In fact, Reines says, let me quote it in Hebrew because it's beautiful. Biyad ha'adam litfos et ha'emet biyado tu'udato bolamo hirak. No, he says, Ve'ein bi'adam. A person cannot grab the truth in his hand. Ve'ein bi'adam, litfos et ha'emet bi'ado. Tudato bo'olamo, hirak levakesh et ha'emet. We're never going to get to the truth. We can't get to the truth, but we can try to get to the truth. And that's what it's all about. So when the Gemara says that all sides come from one shepherd, it means that not the content, not everything we say is from one shepherd, but the study. Study itself is God's will. Now, we don't have time to go into it, so let me just briefly say what I was going to say. Okay, that's good, Yisrael. I was going to, if I had more time, develop the machlokas between him and Rav Kook, which obviously in Rav Kook's perspective, the land of Israel is very messianic. Reines also speaks about, he's very much a pacifist, incidentally, that our role is not to be involved in military things. Rav Kook, on the contrary, saw the recreation of an army as a very positive thing. I have in my notes here, let me just tell you one more thing that Weinberg quoted. When Weinberg went to Reines, Weinberg also was very close to Reines, and he asked Reines, why are you still involved in Zionism? If they have so many non-religious, and Reines replies that he understands the Haredim, why they oppose it, but he is like a father. And when your children are all astray, you try to bring them close. He has a whole book, Or Chadash Al Tzion, in which he discusses whether we can see religious significance in what the Zionists are doing, even if they're not religious. And he claims that, God is still involved, even if they don't know any better. Not messianic, but God's involved. Just a couple more things. There is tension in his writing, though, because it seems that although Reines, in many places, speaks about just going back to the land of Israel is only to improve the physical circumstances of the Jews, help them live a Torah life, but it's not about messianic stuff, it's not about bringing the Mashiach. In some places, he seems to go the other direction. He waxes poetic differently, so it is a bit of a stira. Shapiro discusses this, but Rov Minyan Ubinyan, the majority position of Rav Reines, and he explains this in detail, is that this is only a this-worldly thing. I don't understand, and Shapiro never really explains, gets a handle, why Reines was so committed to seeing this in a non-messianic approach. So why was everything this worldly? It's not like he could have anticipated that you'd have the Gush Emunim and then the failures and this and that, but it seems from the beginning unless he just had this conception of the Messiah, Messianic era, as being totally miraculous, and therefore what we do has nothing to do with it. But why should he have that conception? The Rambam didn't have that conception. I'm not really sure. There's another contradiction. Ehud Luz, who wrote a book on the issue of the religious Zionists and the non-religious, points out another contradiction in his writing. On the one hand, he calls on the Orthodox to join the Zionist movement so that religion has a place in Zionism. On the other hand, he tells the secular Zionists to stick to political and practical Zionism so that the Orthodox are not turned off. It's a bit of a contradiction because to the Orthodox, he wants them to bring their spirit to it. But for the non-Orthodox, you know, for them, it only has to be political. Obviously, from his perspective, it's not a contradiction. But from the non-Orthodox, it's a big contradiction. The non-Orthodox thought that they also had a spirit. They were also spiritual. It just wasn't a spirituality like the Orthodox. One more point. It was Kirov. It wasn't Zionism was Kirov. It was the general welfare of the Jews. It was not what today we think of as Zionism. But then again, what was Rav Soloveitchik's Zionism? Do you know that pre-67, the Mizrahi was also almost like a pacifist party? Read what's his name? The guy from the Hartman, not the Hartman, the Shalem Institute, who wrote the book on the Six-Day War. I forget his name. He's from my town, West Orange. Oren. He writes about how during the Six-Day War, the NRP, they were questioning whether they should even move into East Jerusalem. They were very much pacifists. Let me just mention one more thing. No, I don't think he's considered a follower. I think the follower of today's Zionism is Rav Kook. He was considered the founder and the leader of Zionism until 67. Now, post-Oslo, post-Gush Katif withdrawal, you have people returning to the Reines model, I think, very much. Simcha Krauss gave a lecture saying similar things. Rabbi Blau, I think, published an article on this. The Rav Soloveitchik model, you have people returning to this. I think Rav Lichtenstein holds this model also, but for so many years it was submerged by the Rav Kook, Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kook model as well. Let me just give you one example, and then we'll conclude with this, because Yisrael and maybe some others wanted an example of Chakira or of a Lithuanian Talmudic analysis. So, you know, there's a chapter in this book by Rav Shiel Raphael, but it's too complicated. But I found one I think is a good example. According to the Shulchan Aruch, and we'll conclude with this. According to the Shulchan Aruch, if you sell someone something that's not kosher, from the Torah. That is, if you sell them something that mina Torah, like a pig or something, is not kosher, and the purchaser eats it, you have to return his money. You have to return the money. But if it was forbidden from the rabbis, as you sell them something that's only forbidden from the rabbis, let's say chicken mixed with milk or something like that, and he eats it, you don't have to return the money. Now, the commentators on the Shulchan Aruch, they can't seem to find a reason why. Why should there be a difference if I sell someone something that's forbidden from the Torah and he eats it? It's a false sale. I sold him something that's treif. He didn't know any better. He ate it. I should have to refund his money. Or if you sell him something that's only forbidden from the rabbis, that you don't have to return the money. So this is what Ravina says. He asks, well, first of all, why do we have to return the money if you sell it and it's forbidden from the Torah? He says it's a mekach taut. It's a the sale. It's a false sale. It's a phony sale. It's like if I sell you a car without an engine. Obviously, it's not a binding sale because ikar chasam in a sefer. You know, the main thing is missing. Rhinus explains. No, you didn't know it's treif. That's the point. You didn't know it's treif either. Perhaps it was an accident. Rhinus explains why there's no mekach taut with something forbidden midrabanan. He says that when something is forbidden from the Torah, there is actually a change in what he calls etzem hachafetz, using this philosophical terminology, which shows you that it would be difficult for his method to catch on. That is, the piece of meat, which you say is sold it to him, saying it's kosher, it really is non-kosher. Even if you say it's kosher, and a person thinks it's kosher, by definition it's non-kosher, and therefore it's a mekach taus. It's a false sale because you were selling something kosher, and this is not kosher. An iser derabanan, though, when something is forbidden from the rabbis, it doesn't cause a change in the essence of the object. It doesn't turn it into essentially treif. It just forbids us to eat it and sell it. It doesn't change the nature of the object. For example, let me give you an example. If, according to Ravinus, if you have a situation where it's a kosher animal, but it's shechted treif, by definition, it's a different type of meat. On the other hand, if you, for example, have two pieces of non-kosher meat, and a piece of kosher meat drops in, that's a different example, I don't want to get to it. But a piece of meat, which is only a rabbinic prohibition, min ha-Torah, it still is a piece of kosher meat. The rabbis have just said that it's forbidden for us to sell it, but it's kosher meat. Technically, it's kosher meat. We just can't sell it because the rabbis tell us not to, but the etzem ha-chafetz, the actual object, min ha-Torah, is still kosher. Therefore, there is no mekach taus. Therefore, when I sell you a kosher object, if by definition the object is treif, it's not a valid sale, it's no good. However, if from the Torah the object is kosher, but the rabbi said it's not kosher, the only thing the rabbi said about us is that we can't eat it, that's not enough to void a sale that is a normal sale, because the only reason it'll be a mekach taus is because if it was treif, but technically it's not treif. And he goes into details. What does it mean, an object? The idea. The example I was going to give you was that there's a big machlokas. We all know the halacha, right, that if you have two pieces of kosher and a piece of treif falls into the kosher, and you can't see the difference. Two pieces of kosher meat and a piece of treif meat falls in, so now you have three pieces of meat. We all know that you're allowed to eat all three pieces of meat. Today, of course, no one would do that because they'd say, oh, you know, I want to be strict. I will tell you that if you look in some commentaries, they say if you don't eat the meat, you try to be super pious, it's actually a terrible thing. You're committing a terrible sin, because if Chazal say that something can be batal, then you should follow Chazal. But okay, the question which is raised is, so now you have three pieces of meat. How to understand this? Is it that the third piece of meat, the non-kosher meat, is really non-kosher, but it's just that the rabbis, you know, the Torah tells us that we're allowed to eat it? Or is it that the third piece of meat, similar to what Rhinus was speaking about, actually changes? It now becomes a piece of kosher meat, by definition. So you're going to say, well, what's the practical Nafka mean, the difference? Is this just Lithuanian Talmudists who like to come up with these strange ideas? After all, you can eat it. Who cares? There's a big difference. What happens if after I have two pieces of kosher and a piece of non-kosher fall in, and then an hour later, another piece of non-kosher falls in? If I hold that when the first piece of kosher meat fell in, it really is treif, but it's just that we're allowed to eat treif if it's a majority, then when the fourth piece falls in, now it's 2-2, so we can't eat any of the meat. If, however, you hold that the piece of non-kosher meat, as soon as it becomes subsumed in the majority, itself becomes kosher, then this can go on forever. Another piece of non-kosher meat can fall in, and now it's 3-1. And if an hour later, if another piece falls in, it's 4-1. It shouldn't surprise you if I tell you that it's a machokas. You have people on each side of the issue, and the practical nafka meat is, what happens if after the third piece of meat falls in, then a fourth piece of meat? Some say you can't eat it because it's 2-2. Some say you can eat it because it's 3-1. These are the sorts of problems that Rav Reines was involved in, but not just him, obviously. So, with this, we end. We had to skip a little, but we end with Rav Reines. We will pick up in February with Rav Chaim Hirshenstein if we have questions. And, no, this is not a new method. This is not a new method, actually. This chakir I gave you actually goes back to the Rishonim. But this is the sort of thing, that Briskers and others were very involved in. They got to such an extreme. There's a famous Telzer chakira, which Weinberg called a foolish Telzer chakira. When you die, is that you no longer have life, or that you now have death? So they wanted to determine, is a dead person one who is lacking life or who has death? And they came up with all these nafkaminas, but the example I gave you was a classic example. It's not really, but it's the sort of thinking that in the Brisker tradition and the other Lithuanian traditions, everything is like that. Everything has to be conceptualized, so much so that in the eulogy for the Brisker Rav, Rav Soloveitchik says, and this is his famous quote, that when Rav Chaim came around, the pots and pans, you know, halachic theory comes, it was no longer just the pots and the pans, you know, what you traditionally learn Yoredeya to know what the halacha was. Even the pots and pans, even the halachas of Yoredeya became profound conceptual understandings over, you know, why you can do this, why you can't do that. What's the other nafka mina? Well, that would relate to what we said to Rav Reines, exactly, whether, from his perspective, whether it's a Daraisa treif or Darabanan treif, etc. I don't know which book, but we had Zionist Hasidim. You had many, mostly in the Chernobyl dynasty. You had Romero, mostly the Rishoners. You had a lot of Zionist feeling in it. So there were people. You had a person called the Ha'admor HaHasidi. Rav Yishaya Shapira was known as the Hasidic Admor for Hasidim. So you have many individuals. In terms of Rebbe's, it's really from the Rishoners and some of the Chernobyls that were very much interested in Chav Beit Zion. In fact, one of them, one of the Chernobyls, was even a Mizrachiite, officially a Mizrachiite. If you look in Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook's letters to his father, he describes how he went to Vienna, the various Hasidic Rebbe's he spoke to who were very supportive of what his father was doing. And so, like I said, some were Mizrahi supporters. And you always had supporters of Zionism, even in the Hasidic groups, even if the Rebbe's were not, unlike today. I don't know which book. Oh, no, I do know which book. Yitzhak Raphael. Yitzhak Alfasi, who's written a number of books on Hasidism. He has a book, positive, it's Yitzhak Alfasi, about Zionism in the Hasidic courts. So look on the Harvard catalog under Alfasi, Yitzhak Alfasi. Yeah, Yitzhak Alfasi, yes, a number of books on Hasidut. That's got to be a name they gave. He's Ashkenazi. He's in his 80s now. It has to be a name that they gave him when he came to Israel. He was Rav Gorin's assistant, I believe, but he has about 35 books on Hasidut. Not scholarly, but not hagiographic. Somewhere in that middle ground, and some fascinating stuff. Any other questions or comments as we conclude what has been another very nice semester? As always, I thank you for your comments and questions and the emails offline and the many people who've been listening from MP3 who've commented the corrections. Thank you, Kenneth. Okay, well, then let me just tell everyone and try to get your friends, other people to join with us. We're going to be starting in February with Rav Chaim Hirschenson. I guarantee you've never heard anything like Rav Chaim Hirschenson, some of the most strange and interesting stuff. We will move on then to Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank, Rav Yitzchak Nissim, and if we have time, with Rav Sholem Mesas, the whole Moroccan tradition. Yeah, email me. Thank you very much, everyone.
Mark, I want to thank you for your enlightening series again. I want to thank the Emerson family, Stanley and Ilam Emerson, once again for sponsoring this series, and to everybody who helps make it possible, and Yasha Koach, and we look forward to seeing you soon. And of course, by the way, Mark will be in Toronto February 7th and 8th, the weekend of the 7th and 8th, for our conference on Shim Shem Rafael Hirsch, the 200th year since his birthday. But, okay, thank you to everybody, and Chag Sameach.
Okay, good.
We hope you found this recording a most enjoyable learning experience. We welcome your feedback. Please contact us at info@torahinmotion.org or at www.torahinmotion.org. Have a great day. Thank you.